The Netflix series Bridgerton is a bona fide hit. In its first month of release, 82 million people tuned in to see a sexy cast of actors dolled up in Regency-era costumes and tearing off those costumes for a miniseries depiction of the popular novels by Julia Quinn. But super producer Shonda Rhimes made one major change to the books. While on the page, just about every character is white or presumed white, the creator of Grey's Anatomy, Private Practice, and Scandal fills the screen also with actors of color, and viewers cannot get enough. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There are people who object to this modern casting, people who insist that in the Regency period in which the romance is set, England had only white people, and therefore the casting choices are historically inaccurate. But not only was Regency England much more diverse than many people choose to believe, there is also the question of why a perceived racial anachronism is a problem for viewers who don't bat an eye at the fact that every character has straight teeth brought to us by modern dentistry, and there's not a single hairy female leg or armpit to be found. So why aren't there more romance books written about anybody other than white, cisgender, straight people? Zaha Rehman is a freelance journalist who often writes about culture. Her article, Adding Color to the Romance Genre, appears on The Walrus. Zaha, welcome to Think.
Hi, glad to be here.
So tell us more about how the Bridgerton miniseries compares to the books that inspired it.
Okay, so I read the series, the entire Bridgerton series, about a decade ago when I was about 11 or 12, and I reread it after the release of the series, and there were absolutely no main leads or like romantic leads that were of color or queer, and like no racialized characters at all, even in like in terms of background characters. The only queer character appeared in about the last book of the series, and even then he was like a fiance who was ready to trap the heroine in like a loveless marriage. So there hasn't really been, you know, like a lot of representation in terms of like queer or racialized characters in this series at all that the TV series showed.
And the TV series has been like successful beyond all expectations.
Yes, definitely. It's again, like you said, 82 million viewers in like the very first month.
What makes it so addictive?
I think people like in a time that is very uncertain, it's refreshing to kind of escape to a time that is far away, filled with lovely costumes and, you know, just love, right? I think like, again, that's what makes the series so attractive. And also, again, like admittedly, the very, very attractive Duke.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of eye candy on the show. So Bridgerton is what's considered a Regency romance. And I just assumed that term meant like all old timey costume romance novels. But in fact, it's a really specific time period, right?
Yes, it's very specific. So Regency is refers to 1811 and 1812 England, and it's sort of preceded by the Georgian era and kind of like followed by the Victorian era. But again, like the Regency is very, very specifically like 1811 and 1820 England.
Are there particular conventions to Regency romances that wouldn't necessarily be expected in other romances set in, you know, long ago times and faraway places?
Well, admittedly, I'm not. A lot of historical romances are written in Regency fiction, so I'm almost more familiar with Regency than. So I'm a bit unfamiliar with the conventions of like of the any other like genre. I mean, time period, just because Regency is just overwhelmingly like where historical romance is set. And again, Regency, you know, romance focuses a lot about like aristocrats, so like titled like lords and ladies, and you know, like costumes and balls.
Okay, and part of the reason maybe that Regency became the period, these 9 years or whatever, is that's when Jane Austen was writing, right?
Yes, exactly. So Jane Austen sort of immortalized the era, and then Georgia Hare sort of popularized it. And so that's, you know, sort of become like, you know, it's sort of become associated with historical romance. So, you know, when you look for historical romance, you'll overwhelmingly find, you know, historical romances set in the Regency era.
Okay, so Let's talk about the objections some people have to the fact that Bridgerton boasts this multiracial cast. Folks insist they're not being racist. There just were no people of color in Britain in the 18-teens, except there totally were, right?
Yes, of course. So, you know, like England or like Britain, British settlers, you know, they arrived in India and like the West Indies in, you know, and in Africa by like the mid 1600s, right? So to kind of assume that, you know, like the British settlers were there, but like no people, like, you know, like ever came back to England is kind of like ludicrous, right? Like you can't look up a lot of, you know, like British families returning from India brought, you know, like ayahs or like Indian maids with them. A lot of Indian sailors like settled in Liverpool and they were called Lascars. And, you know, like Black people have been in England, you know, like they arrived through this transatlantic like slave transatlantic slave trade, and like, yeah, so they were, you know, like a lot of Black and brown people in England at that time, you know, like the Gentleman's Trade magazine, I believe, you know, like, you know, estimated that there were about like 20,000, you know, like Black servants working in England in about like 1700, which is, you know, even before the Regency era. So I think that claim is a bit ludicrous.
And there were presumably mixed race couples and families during those years as well.
Yes, definitely. So an author that I talked to, you know, Vanessa Riley, and she brought up Jane Austen's like unfinished novel Sanditon, which featured, you know, like a mulatto woman and kind of like, you know, like men vying to marry her because, you know, like she was rich. So yes, there were definitely a lot of, you know, like mixed race, like couples and children. And unfortunately, like as Vanessa Riley told me, a lot of the times the history has been written as they were white. So this sort of been erased from history.
Oh, that's interesting. And of course, Bridgerton, the series also has queer characters. By all accounts, queer people have been with us. They've been part of every human population ever, essentially.
Yes, yes. You can find, again, a lot of the times the history is kind of like erased or kind of overlooks it, you know, but again, if you look hard, like a lot of the authors that I interviewed, you know, like have done, you'll find, you know, a lot of queer characters in history.
And we all understand, this is the part that I don't get. We all understand that Bridgerton is a fantasy, right? Nobody is claiming that this show, these books are an accurate depiction of pretty much anything about life in the early 1800s in England.
Yes, of course. And I think that is where the claims of historical inaccuracy kind of, you know, like feel ludicrous, because if you can kind of extend your imagination to accept that, you know, like these, you know, like these women, like you said, have like shaved bodies, they have straight teeth, you know, they have great dental hygiene, that there are like numerous lords, you know, like instead of just like 31, which Gail Eastwood estimated there were, you know, like there's numerous lords and they're all handsome and they're all wealthy. If you can extend your imagination to kind of accept that, you know, like, why can't you extend your imagination to accept that they were like Black and brown people in that era, right?
Does the series deal with race specifically? Like, are there conversations between characters who fall in love that might be different races about that fact?
So that's a very interesting and kind of like an ongoing conversation. So there's been a lot of debate about that. When I watched the series, I just recall kind of one conversation in passing, you know, about how, I guess, like Black people came to be accepted in England, but and I'm not Black, so I can't, you know, like speak a lot to that, but there were a lot of conversations about how, there were a lot of conversations about how like some people felt that it didn't represent the Black experience accurately, or like what the Black experience would have been in that era. So again, like a very interesting and kind of ongoing debate about that.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's maybe been done as almost kind of a colorblind casting. Like, we're not going to ask ourselves whether power structures in the early 19th century would have allowed, I don't know the series well, but would have allowed someone to be a lord or a lady if they were a person of color. So it's almost as if race becomes a thing that doesn't matter in the series.
Yes, I think you put it quite well. Again, like there are Black characters, but there's not a lot of nuances to how their Blackness informs the experience in the era.
Okay. So there is precedent, right, for characters of color in some romance novels. But as you note, a lot of those examples have been pretty cringeworthy over time.
Yes. So there have been, you know, like Middle Eastern heroes. I mean, Middle Eastern heroes are always kind of like characterized as like, you know, like these savage sheikhs who are redeemed by like white women's love. There's a lot of, excuse me, indigenous heroes who are characterized as like, you know, these like savages who are again redeemed by white women. Similarly for like Asian heroes and heroines, like Asian heroines are typically as very timid and kind of like, you know, like submissive. So there have been, you know, like a few racialized or like biracial characters in some historical romances, but again, it requires a lot of research and nuance, you know, and a lot of sensitivity, which sometimes I think some authors might not be well equipped to deal with.
So when you started reading these at, you said 11 or 12 books like these, did you notice the fact that all the characters seemed to be white and straight?
I was quite young at that time, and unfortunately I didn't have the critical thinking skills to kind of notice that, because honestly, everything around me was white, so I didn't question it at the time. It was only later, more recently, when, you know, the conversations about representation have become more mainstream, that I began to notice, like, oh, you know, like, these books that I like, you know, like, don't feature anybody who looks like me, or just anybody who is not, you know, like, white, or cisgender, or, like, you know, like, non-heterosexual, or, like, you know, not able-bodied.
I've wondered if part of the problem here is that, for all its popularity, the romance genre in general is not always taken that seriously as a form of literature, not least because I think people associate it with the reading that women do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. Yeah. A lot of the times, again, the romance genre is not taken very seriously. It's kind of dismissed as like, you know, like fluffy stories or kind of just like, you know, like porn for women. But I think the power that romance has is, one, it brings a lot of comfort to people, right? In a, again, a world that is increasingly uncertain, it is comforting to see two people overcome obstacles and find a happy ending. And two, when you have more representation in it, it kind of sends the message that, you know, like everybody deserves love.
So it sounds like people are starting to write these books. Maybe it's not always easy for those books to be published and marketed the same way books by white authors are.
Yes, definitely. So, you know, again, and like I said, it's only been more recently that we have more historical romances featuring more diverse characters. For the longest time, it was really only Beverly Jenkins, you know, like writing, you know, diverse historical romance. She's been writing since 1993, and her books, you know, wonderful books feature, you know, Black characters. But it's only more recently that there have been more authors. So you have Alyssa Cole and Courtney Milan, and Piper Hewley and Vanessa Riley. And again, a lot of these authors that I talked to, especially, you know, Vanessa Riley and Piper Hewley, they told to me that when they start pitching their books, you know, their historical romances that had diverse characters, a lot of them were turned away by traditional publishers. And so they had to turn to self-publishing.
And what makes I guess we sort of understand how self-publishing works, but is it harder to make money that way? Is it harder to get your work noticed?
Of course, yes. Yeah. So with a traditional publishing house, as I understand it, you know, like, again, you are paid to write the book. And then when your book is released, the publishing house promotes it, you know, so they can send it out to reviewers and they can have it, you know, kind of have like mainstream like outlets kind of writing about it. Self-publishing, you know, can be costly. You might have to, you have to spend kind of like your own money, you know, if you want to write a good book. To one, you have to spend time to write it, then you have to get it edited. You might have to hire, you know, like a graphic design team to kind of like do the layout and the cover. And then again, it's harder to promote the book, because you just don't have as many resources as a, you know, as like a big publisher would, you know, as many contacts. So again, like definitely self-publishing is quite hard.
Some writers have said to you they've encountered this problem where gatekeepers in the publishing industry will essentially say, like, we already have a Black novelist, or we already have a novelist of Asian descent, like as if there could be too many because this is supposed to be for white people.
Yes, exactly, right? And you, it's not just kind of limited to, you know, like romance novels. You know, you see it in like movies or like TV series too, right?
So when you find something that appeals to you that does feel like there's at least room for characters of color to be a major part of the action. I mean, obviously you latched on to Bridgerton, but you already knew the book series. What does it feel like to you to find content that feels relevant?
It honestly feels pretty amazing. I can't really describe to you the feeling, right? Like I've cried reading some books, like, because I've never felt so seen, you know. It's in, you know, like a pop culture where I rarely feel seen, or I rarely feel that people, you know, like understand me or my lived experience. To have somebody write that and kind of like, you know, like write and have that be read by a mainstream audience, it just makes me feel like, you know, like I am valid and my lived experiences are valid, and there are other people who have experienced the same things as me, and I'm not an anomaly and I'm not an outsider.
So if romance novels, and these in particular, sell so well, it seems strange that the publishing industry is so risk averse, that they keep encouraging authors to crank out more of what they're already familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, like gatekeeping in the publishing industry, right? It's very money motivated, and it's easier to, you know, like go with a safe decision than the risky one. And the risky one, you know, unfortunately, often features like romances with diverse characters.
So how does word get around when somebody self-publishes a book with more diverse characters, with queer characters, with, you know, plot lines that maybe don't resemble many of the beloved books from the past? Are people just texting each other and posting online about self-published works they've discovered?
I think Twitter has been, you know, like a game changer in terms of increasing romance readership for diverse novels. You know, a lot of the times you'll see, you know, like a lot of these authors are friends and they promote each other's work, you know, and the word of mouth through Twitter has been, you know, a big reason for, you know, the rise of a lot of these authors, right? So like Courtney Milan, you know, is pretty active on Twitter, and then you'll see her kind of promoting, you know, other authors' work, and that's kind of how people discover, you know, like more authors and more novels.
I don't know if you're very familiar, and you might have mentioned her, with Beverly Jenkins, who does a Black Regency romance. My understanding
of
is that
course.
She's popular not just with Black audiences, but with audiences. It would seem like publishing houses would be like, we want more Beverly Jenkins-like writers.
Yes, of course. Beverly Jenkins is like a legend in the romance industry. But unfortunately, that has not been the case. I recall during my interview with Piper Hewley, you know, she said that a friend of hers who wanted to write like a Black historical romance was told that, again, like, we already have Beverly Jenkins, so we don't need, you know, more romance novels. And that's just baffling to me.
Hmm. Did you have any particular challenges pitching this article to the editors at The Walrus?
Unfortunately, no. The editors were, you know, they replied quite fast to this piece. But I think I did pitch this piece, you know, for quite a while, however, and I don't think that a lot of the editors kind of realized the popularity that the Bridgerton series was going to have. The piece did face a lot of rejections before it was finally accepted.
Do you think it's sexism that the, you know, books, romance novels aren't necessarily taken seriously in a way that like action adventure spy novels with a presumably heavily male audience are?
Yes, I think it's definitely sexism, and a lot of the, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, discussion about that, you know, on Twitter and in articles, you know, that again, like, because the primary readership, you know, of the genre is women, it's often dismissed as, you know, like just fluff or just like porn for women.
Have you thought about writing something like a romance novel yourself?
Of course I have, yes, but, you know, it is something that requires a lot of time and dedication, you know, and it's definitely easier to, it's definitely easier to have, you know, like financial stability before you decide to embark on writing one. So, yes, I think I would like more financial stability before I embark on novel writing.
What has your reading been like in this year of pandemic? Have you been sort of required to socially isolate? Are you working mostly from home?
Yes, yeah, so I'm a freelance journalist, and I currently live in Ontario, Canada, a province that is under very strict lockdown. So I have been working from home, and my reading has been, it's been mostly romance because I'm craving, comfort. I want to read about people overcoming obstacles and being happy because I'm hoping, that I can also, overcome this huge obstacle that is, the pandemic, but also like the job market, right? And just find happiness, right? But because of the sociopolitical climate of the world, it's also been a lot of, memoirs and nonfiction as well.
Yeah, I mean, I read a lot of heavy stuff for work, but I always say nobody should be judged for the things they like to read in their spare time. There's no good reason why we shouldn't also read what just simply gives us pleasure.
Yes, definitely. And a lot of times, the people feel, or people call romance novels their guilty pleasure, but I don't think there should be any guilt, associated with reading something that brings you joy.
So, how do you find the, or do you always have like books queued up that you're ready to read? How do you find the next thing that you're going to go to?
So I think I do have a pretty long to be read list, but a lot of the times I'll read what I'll try to see what's new with authors that I already like, see if they're publishing anything, and also like Goodreads has a lovely section called Readers Also Liked, so I'll check if there are any books in there that interest me. Twitter, if you follow a lot of authors, is also a great resource for finding books. So yeah, it's been like a mixture of Twitter and Goodreads.
So, of course, we would like to see, many people would like to see more diversity in this genre, and maybe authors are getting the message. It also raises questions about cultural appropriation, right? What is your thinking about whether a writer who doesn't share the background of a character creates a major character of a different race or ethnic background?
Yes, and that's a very, again, like important ongoing debate about whether you should write people, who are not like you. And again, I've talked to like four different authors. I've talked to, like Piper Hewley and Kat Sebastian and Vanessa Riley and KJ Charles. And I think, and KJ Charles, is she writes racialized characters and she writes, like neurodiverse characters and queer characters. And I think the overwhelming kind of, responses, as long as you do research and that research can involve, like talking to people from that community and going to talking to professors and historians and reading a lot of books. I think as long as you do research, and like have sensitivity readers, I think it shouldn't be a problem.
Sensitivity readers, people of that culture or race who can say, yeah, this adds up for me, or no, this doesn't sound accurate.
Yes.
All right. Zaha Rehman is a freelance journalist who often writes about culture. Her article, Adding Color to the Romance Genre, appears on The Walrus. Zaha, thanks very much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilufer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.